As has so often been the case, the events taking place around ET and UFO encounters tend to open a door to further, more complex tales. When witnesses speak, documents are found, and the timeline grows more mature, the details surrounding the event tend to take on the appearance of bacteria splitting and dividing under a microscope. The story begins to expand its presence, feeding on every new lead and spreading until it consumes the researcher's mind as each cell makes contact with the unlimited variables that exist in any given moment. Life, in all its forms, is a beautiful thing. So what is Sweep Clear 5? It's a moment in time, just a few minutes of contact, that consumed 30 years of a researcher's life, but not without a reason. I didn't see you there.
Something big is going on here.
From hunting ghosts to Bigfoot.
Paranormal, UFOs, true crime, and more.
We won't just be spouting articles.
I was researching for your entertainment.
The beginning of a new world.
The best guac you'll ever fucking eat.
True story.
It's basically like one day you walk outside and you see that the ants are playing with matches.
This is the Black Cat Report.
See you on the other side.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 84 of the Black Cat Report. My name is Gil, and here with me today, the original Lord of Shots, Joey.
I am here, but shotless, sadly, tonight.
Get that man a drink!
You can send shots to the address, beep.
P.O. Box 1313, Mockingbird Lane.
Oh, P.O. Bird.
P.O. Bird. 1313 Mockingbird Lane. You just pour the shot and any glass, disposable's fine too. We don't recycle around here, and just stamp it, set it right in the mailbox. I'm sure it'll get here just fine.
Perfect. Yep.
Yeah. Well, Joey, my man, I got to tell you, I am so stoked to have a full-on nerd level alpha UFO episode today. It has been too damn long.
That's amazing. I do know that a lot of people like to say that use this term alpha male.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go ahead and just label you alpha nerd right now. So this is alpha level nerd.
Okay.
Does that sound good?
I'm actually okay with that.
Yep, that's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. All right. Well, our primary sources for this episode will be the book Sweep Clear 5, NATO's UFO Encounter by Chris Stiles, as well as an episode of Podcast UFO, episode 564, which is an interview between Martin Willis and Chris Stiles. Links to both the book and the interview will be in this episode's show notes. All that said, let's dive in. Now, today's story, like any good UFO story, involves the researcher just as much as those round disks and rapscallions coming down from outer space. It brings us to a brief moment in time that, without question, left something behind with the witnesses that they would carry until their final breath. Further, that same something would serendipitously catch the ear of an up-and-coming researcher who would be left stubbornly chasing its memory for 30 years. That researcher is, of course, author Chris Stiles. Now, as a side note, during this retelling, I'm going to do my best to spare you from the pages upon pages of meta-level detail verification and the chapters of granular justification Chris lays out as he quite literally makes his case for the Sweep Clear 5 incident. So, if you want all that, go buy the book. The man does great work, but his writing approaches the birthing of a love child between a detective thriller and a submission to a peer-reviewed scientific journal. In other words, it's fantastic if you want to learn how to become a better researcher, but going by the book would be too damn dry for your audio pleasure, and we aim to please. So, when necessary, I've summarized the passages that feel like flyover states and combined the verified testimony and details into a more linear breakdown than offered in the actual book itself. That said, I'm not going to lie, the reading gets rough at points. Shout out to my friend who helped research Majestic 12 with me for a pending series still stuck in planning purgatory. Two words, typeface. Now,
You can't just inside joke the inside joke, Gil.
Oh, damn it. I'm going to skip over this. All right. So, basically, forever ago, I had the lofty goal of doing a 12-part series on the Majestic 12, which is an alleged UFO knowledge group that's above top secret and they control everything. And they're said to be behind hiding all of the proof of ET and doing all the crazy black ops, UFO crash retrievals and shit that we'd love to cover on this show. Well, There's 12 members, so basically it would break down into an episode for each of the original 12 members. That's simple enough, right?
Yep.
12-part episode, basically 12 mini bios with their involvement and shit. Yeah, well, thing is, it got really, 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 really hard because the theory or conspiracy behind them all started with an anonymous envelope filled with classified documents showing up at a UFO researcher's house.
Uh-huh.
Right, so like that's like, it's a little sketch, right?
Yeah.
So then Majestic 12 or MJ-12 isn't just about the 12 members or the shit MJ-12 has allegedly done or the complex theories surrounding them. It's also just as much about the years of mind-numbing details that went into investigating if or if not MJ-12 is real. It's a lot.
Yeah.
It spirals quickly into like, is this just a covert disinformation psyop against the UFO community? Yada, yada, yada. Yada, yada, yada. But eventually, like, everything gets more fucked up the farther you go into it, because down the line, new classified MJ-12 documents start popping up, of course, and their claims get even more outrageous than the original documents, which were already like, whoa, holy shit, like a secret UFO control group that like has more clearance than the president, and they're fucking, you know, they got access to,
yeah,
I don't know, fucking free energy and
yeah,
every season of Teletubbies. This is nuts, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we aren't talking about Michael Jordan 24 here. We're talking about the 12 days of Christmas. The 12 days of the Majestic 12.
The Majestic 12 days of Christmas was my idea, not this past Christmas, but the Christmas before. And we all got together to record it after I spent countless nights preparing for it, to which I just punched a wall and said, God damn it, I'm not ready for this. And then we pieced together an episode and it turned out great. But it didn't have shit to do with the MJ-12.
Nope.
Anyways, all those fucking bogus documents that kind of flooded in after the original documents and people starting to look into them and they're like, is this legit? What about these names? Never heard of this person before. Oh, they do have a background. Right. Well, some of them, obviously fucking bogus. Some of them were arguably credible. Right?
Yeah.
People were able to find validation and shit in the claims, and it started to be like, how much of this document is true? Even though 100% of it was never known before this document appeared, 90% of it could be verified. The other 10% is just like, JFK did what with a Martian? Like, it just like fucking goes out there, right?
Hey, I would not doubt that he did what with a Martian.
Why do you think they don't come back anymore?
He scared them out.
How do you think he turned orange? No, that was a condition caused by sex with aliens. But all that eventually leads to one of the greatest UFO researchers of all time, all the MJ-12 documents. It eventually leads to Stan Friedman spending decades of his career meticulously investigating the validity of the MJ-12 papers and eventually dedicating hundreds of pages in his book on the Operation Majestic 12 to the slightest fucking variations in fonts or letterhead formatting and typeface. Why on earth I thought reading the expanded edition of that book was a good place to start, I'll never fucking know. I was like, yeah, this is the pinnacle. This is the main one. I'm fucking starting with the best option. And I was like, oh God, no, I'm not fucking ready for this. But yeah, anywho, friend read it with me. And we're still in group therapy for post-traumatic Stanton disorder.
That's true.
That's basically why I just shouted out the word typeface. It's our support word.
And Stanton didn't waste his whole life doing that to confuse everybody.
The story gets deep, though. Like, if you're not into, like, government misinformation campaigns and shit like that, it does, if you can get past the pages of shit about a half an inch spacing on this typepad was actually standard, but just in this city because there was no standardized format across the federal agencies at the time. And if they had an F-27 typewriter, then the odds of the typist being trained near 1940.
Oh my God.
Like, dude, it just keeps going.
But, oh my God.
But if you can get past that.
I can't.
You can get past that.
I can't.
There's crazy shit that does happen where totally bogus shit pops up in, like, the National Archives.
Uh-huh.
And, like, the people that work at the archives who eventually let, you know, Stanton in, because he's obviously a regular, they start, like, noticing, like, why is this document gone? Why is this da-da-da not here? Why is that? They're like, well, that paper wasn't registered to be in this box. Little shit starts to pop up to the point of, like, fucking notes that are being left for Stanton over, like, decades of digging into, like, the fucking typeface and fonts and shit. And it's, like,
yeah.
The degree to which whoever the fuck was behind the whole thing that they, like, planned it is fucking insane.
Uh-huh. You know what it really was?
Hmm.
It was just Jim from The Office just playing little pranks on Friedman, just going in there. He's just, like, leaving stupid little notes in there, just like, somebody will find this one day.
But, like, somehow Stanton Friedman accidentally stumbled into it.
Yeah. Yes.
Damn it. Well, all that Stanton talk actually brings us back, somehow, to Chris Stiles and Sweep Clear 5. Because, I'm not joking here, Stanton Friedman referred to Chris Stiles, a typeface researcher guy who spent decades going through archives and discovering, like, that dust isn't in the same place as yesterday, that guy. Yeah. And he's a badass.
Brother of Harry Styles.
Harry Styles. But Stanton Friedman referred to Chris Stiles as a bulldog when talking about Chris's approach to investigations. He literally was like, that guy's a bulldog. Like, it's like, if you're getting that level of compliment from Stanton Friedman,
mm-hmm.
holy shit, bro.
Yeah.
There's not enough meth on the planet to compete with that.
Yeah.
Like,
Stan Friedman being the Doberman Pinscher of research.
Yes, clearly. Uh-huh. Clearly. Well, you know, kind of, and not in the negative sense, but in the actual, like, biological sense, kind of like the pit bull, because, like, once he bites on, he just doesn't fucking let go, you know?
True. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, maybe.
Rip that flesh off.
Maybe a mix.
Rip those notes off.
I don't know. He's a rescue. Now. So, Stan Friedman, like I said, one of the most meticulous, scrutiny-driven researchers of all time, called Chris Stiles a bulldog when it came to researching cases. Now, back to the story, which oddly still has to do with Stanton. He makes a cameo here in a second. So, back in 1992, Chris and his friend were watching an Unsolved Mysteries episode about Roswell in which Stan the Man Friedman appeared. The reason for that being that Stanton Friedman was actually the person who made Roswell a household name. Like, you have to remember, there were decades after the Roswell incident in 47 where it totally faded out of public memory.
Yeah.
Like, nobody was talking about it. People just straight up forgot the case. It wasn't until the 80s, I want to say, like, early to mid 80s, when Stanton Friedman started following leads and doing what he does. And he cracked open the Roswell case and actually made it literally synonymous with aliens and UFOs around the entire planet. That was Stanton Friedman,
mm-hmm.
right? So
yeah,
that to give an idea of, like, when he did catch the right lead, that's the level of, like, impact he could have, which is fucking insane.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, that's huge.
As somebody who, like, dabbles in that kind of research, I'm just like, God damn.
Yeah.
Holy shit, my man. Well, anywho, the episode itself, the Roswell episode of Unsolved Mysteries, it inspired Chris to tell his friend he was watching it with about his own UFO sighting a number of years back, where he saw a 60-foot orb he, along with literally tons of other people, all saw on the same night as the now infamous Shag Harbor UFO incident, which sounds like a name for an Austin Powers reboot, but it's not. Well, after Chris told his whole spiel, his friend was like, yo, that's wild. You should report it. And Chris was like, sure. Yeah, I'll do that. Then his friend was like, bro, you saying that now, but you'll forget. And within a few minutes, Chris was peer pressured into making a series of calls that, within about an hour, resulted in him talking directly to Stanton Friedman and telling him his UFO story. And that was 4 pages of the book I just helped you all skip over. Now, here's the thing. The Shag Harbor incident was widely known locally in Shag Harbor, where there were tons of witnesses. It made the front page of the news at the time and was eventually straight up confirmed and classified publicly by the Canadian government that what everyone saw that night was in fact a UFO. Like, this made the Shag Harbor incident the only publicly government documented UFO crash in the world.
That's crazy.
It's a big case, right?
Yeah.
And so basically, that's what it became known as, right? Eventually, over time. But at the time of this phone call back in 1992, Shag Harbor had happened 25 years earlier in 1967. And while the memory of that night was very vivid for residents of Shag Harbor, it pretty much didn't leave the region where it all happened. Just kind of like stayed insular in this area. And again, we're talking like 92, 93 when this is all going down. Internet hasn't taken off yet. And I mean, it would be decades before they would even have computers in Nova Scotia. So
they were internet.
Well, this meant it wasn't really known about to the broader UFO community, even by the biggest names such as Stanton Friedman. So picture this. In hindsight, this phone call that's taking place in this situation, this phone call is essentially like if someone called you out of the blue and was like,
"Howdy, my name's Jesse Marcel, and I just remembered I saw a crashed UFO in a little town called Corona. It's just outside of Roswell, New Mexico, back in 47. Anyways, you ever hear about anything like that happening down there?"
And then you're just like,
"No, I haven't. Well, it was all over the newspapers. Government said they captured a flying saucer. Well, it's not ringing any bells. And well, all right."
Like, that's the equivalent of this phone call.
Yeah, that's crazy to think about.
Yeah. Which is fucking nuts. And this is why I love digging into, like, obscure cases and shit, because it's like, you never know when something like that might pop up, you know?
Pop its little alien head up,
Well, the summary of the transcript of this whole conversation is basically Stanton was like, nope, can't say that I've heard of that. Well, maybe one guy said something about some yellow foam. Anyways, I think if you think you might be onto something, you should look into it. So here's the deal. Let me reach out to some folks and see what I can do for you and try to get you a hold of some walking money so I can help you dig in. That was basically what Stanton Friedman said, which, super fucking nice guy. Dude calls him out of the blue. The whole conversation was like 5 minutes long. Basically, Stan's like, "Well, I ain't gonna fucking look into it, but seems pretty cool. So see if I can pull some strings and get you some money so you can look into it." Like, that's a dope reaction.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, he'd have to go, truthfully, he'd have to go all the way up there and look at microfiche, you know? And he's probably like, "I don't want to go to Canada. This is probably the winner."
He's from Canada.
You know, the guy called him and he probably didn't want to go even farther north.
He was in Texas at a UFO convention, of course, and he was, like, literally waiting on a ride.
Makes sense. Yeah. And he didn't want to go back.
Did y'all ever hear this thing called 60? It's 60 degrees down here. It's crazy.
Yeah. He was dipping his fries in freaking ranch.
In freedom.
Tubs of ranch. And he was like, "I am going to stay here."
"I am so happy."
He was like, "I'm going to change it to Stanley Friedman."
God damn it. Well, fast forward now to Stanton. Right, he pulled through, but then I think it was like a few weeks to like a month, and got a modest research grant, sending Chris, along with a fellow researcher, Doug Ledger, off to the races. This all snowballed into the two of them interviewing endless witnesses, finding all sorts of data, and digging up government documents one after another that frankly put a lot of the current UAP disclosures and leaks in the U.S. here to shame with like a cool Canadian style of transparency. And like, listening to Styles in like interviews, it's really funny because he brought this up a few times in the book, and I think he at least brought it up once in an interview, but he's like, "My friends all told me that I was spoiled with Shag Harbor, that it was all that in a bag of chips, but you know what, that's what I prefer."
I wonder what kind of chips he would prefer, though.
I haven't heard that phrase since like 1995. What?
Yeah, I feel like that was in all those 90s movies.
The interview was from like July of 2023 when he said that. This book came out last year.
He just had got the internet.
That's true.
He just got the internet and he just saw Legally Blonde.
So, "Oh, what's this? Oh, free trial of AOL." Oh, did you know you could find movies on here? It's pretty cool.
legally blonde. Well, I mean, you can clearly see she's legal. I don't know why there needs to be litigation involved in this, but well, it's on the free channel, so I guess turns out this is a humor piece. This is nice. This is a terrible impression of him. He actually seems like really chill.
he's probably a super great guy. I mean, he did so much research to get this pushed up there, and that's always commendable. By a BCR clap.
Get that man a drink.
Yeah. Well, soon Chris and Doug built such an overwhelming case, obviously with this like limitless supply of people that were willing to talk about it. And why wouldn't they be willing to? The government literally declared, this is a UFO that you saw.
Yeah.
Like, that's a very intense form of validation for folks to come out and speak about it.
Yeah.
Especially when the whole fucking town is admitting to seeing it. Like, nobody's living in, like, fear of losing their career if they say they saw some lights.
Yeah.
Like, if anything, they would feel like idiots were taking a nap early that evening. Like, damn it, I missed it. You know?
Oh, yeah, that would be worse if, like, everybody's... It's like the TV show everybody's talking about where you're just like, I didn't watch it. And they just literally tell you the ending, too. You're like, well, I guess I'm not going to friggin' watch the last episode. Thanks. That's what that person is like.
I kind of appreciate those people because they help me save time by not actually having to watch the TV show, which allows me to have more time to procrastinate on watching the other shows that I haven't watched. So
I absolutely hate those people. And you know, I don't take strong stances on a lot of things. I'm pretty, like, pretty even-keeled, pretty in the middle about most stuff.
True.
But I hate those people that talk about that. Because I was freaking, back in the day when The Avengers was good, mm-hmm. Marvel was making great stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, they make some good stuff now. They literally, I know I'm throwing us off the rails for a second, but I have to. I care about this. Freaking somebody was walking around and they were like, oh, I was like, I'm waiting to see Endgame. I'm not gonna, or Infinity War. I don't want to see it until it like in theaters. I don't want to hear about it. And like, I was one day later and somebody at a party was like, oh, you mean the one where everybody dies? And I was like, fuck you.
Are you talking about the reality TV show we're about to film right now, motherfucker? Who the fuck said that?
What? Yeah. I was just like, this is the worst.
Oh, damn.
She was also wrong. Everybody didn't die. Spoiler alert after I said it, but you should have seen this movie by now.
Well, soon, Chris and Doug built such an overwhelming case that Shag Harbor became internationally known and was coined Canada's Roswell. And that was back before that was just like everything got called that, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, this inevitably launched Chris into a professional career as a UFO researcher investigator, right? So, like, still doing that to this day.
Yeah.
Ever the purist, Chris found himself both dumbfounded and determined when he was struck by both pure luck and hard luck around a year into starting their initial investigation. You see, the distance between 25 and 32 years in someone's memory is only as far as their reference points,
mm-hmm.
what they can remember from before and after around the time of something happening, right? So, like, Joey, you love Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Correct. I do.
When did you first listen to them?
Probably when I was about 14 or 15, 13 maybe, but I think 14, yeah.
Why do you say that?
Why do I say that?
Yeah. Why are you saying 15 maybe?
Well,
13 maybe.
15 maybe, because that's probably when I heard my first song of Lynyrd Skynyrd and was able to like process that it was Lynyrd Skynyrd.
But like, how do you remember that it was at that age?
Because that's when I started playing guitar and when I started learning guitar. So it's about the time I had. So it was an experience on an experience.
Exactly. Right. And so my reference to that would be like the first time that I had a Choco Taco. I'm pretty sure I was still in fourth grade because I remember I was at my friend Mark's house and we were watching Harley Davidson and Marble Man when we went into his kitchen and raided his freezer and found them. So it had to have been before fifth grade because that's when Mark got a dirt bike and I was too poor to get a Yamaha PW80, so we stopped hanging out as much.
Vaya con Dios, amigo.
Well, point is, when we try to put significant life-changing events like our first Choco Tacos on a timeline in our memory, we rationalize their placement as being before or after other memories, right? That's just kind of how brains work.
Uh-huh.
And for UFO nerds, if it's not accurate to the exact goddamn second,
We will cry ourselves to sleep every single night in a dark room while the X-Files theme plays on repeat and everyone mocks us on blogs. In other words, accuracy eats at us and eats away at the credibility of a case. And so when Chris and Doug were interviewing witnesses who were all referencing a mass UFO sighting that happened in the same region, all around the same time, honest assumptions about the accuracy of when people said something happened had to be made, and everything had to be based on overall averages and supporting records.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the two stories got mixed up. Chris takes full accountability for this mistake every single time he talks about Shag Harbor and the Sweep Clear 5 incident. When he puts out his research and essentially built the common narrative around Shag Harbor, he made an honest whoopsie-daisy and mixed up the two different UFO events. Who the hell would have thought that there were two separate, incredible UFO events in the same area, around the same time, in similar harbors, with similar types of people and professions involved? That's like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that's a lot at the same spot. I mean, just as a hot spot, I guess.
Yeah, well, like, you know, you're interviewing like 50, 60, 70, 150 people, and seven or eight of them are all kind of saying the exact same thing or referencing the same situation, but they're all like remembering the year wrong. That's going to fuck with you.
Yeah.
You're going to be like, hey, they must be kind of confused.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Again, 20-something, 30-something years earlier, reference points, and you got to look at the whole average, and you're like, they're probably mixing this up. He would be like, well, was it around like, you know, like 67? And they're like, no, I feel like it was like sometime around just like just before the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was in 1962. 30 years, 25 years, 32 years, a very fine line, you know?
Yeah. Dates got to be super correct, down to the minute.
Down to the goddamn second. Well,
uh-huh.
Alas, after 30 years of these inconsistencies just digging at him, that's when he uncovered it. There were two separate events. The first, Shelburne Harbor in October of 1960, which, as the Corolla drives, is about 31 miles from Shag Harbor, which are now the more famous of the two events that took place. But Shag Harbor took place 7 years later, almost exactly in October of 1967. Again, even the fucking months were the same, and they were a few days off from each other.
Yeah, so crazy.
So, yeah, like,
That's awful. That's awful. I already have problems with remembering today's the 9th or 10th or whatever dates. The 10th, I think.
It's 1960. The Cold War is well underway. It's only been a couple weeks since Richard Nixon looked like a zombie on the first televised presidential debate, which essentially secured the win for JFK, who is now only months away from entering the White House and Marilyn Monroe. At this point, thank you. The tensions between the Eastern commies and the Western capitalists are officially a global anxiety. Both sides have nukes, and now everyone is just waiting for the Bloods and Crips to do a drive-by in their national neighborhood. No one wants to be in this crossfire, but everyone is being forced to choose sides. Cue in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, a.k.a. NATO.
NATO.
Formed in 1949, shortly after the end of World War II, as a result of the Soviets and the U.S. officially changing their Facebook status from frenemies to enemies. This all eventually spiraled into both sides squatting up, and they both started to recruit nations everywhere, basically drafting them to play for one of the only two pro teams in the Nuclear Superpower League, right? Now, the U.S.'s first round picks were Canada and England for reasons of syrup and tea, while the Soviets made a series of unexpected moves for their first round choices by gobbling up parts of Eastern Europe and calling each place they took a Soviet, essentially trying to eat international borders until they filled up the global stadium and were literally just too big to bomb. And that scared the shit out of the West.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stalin, definitely.
He was doing anything but. So, shit's popping off everywhere. Nukes are the coolest thing since Jesus, and NATO actually has an important role in politics as a huge collective military with agreements in place to defend each other from being eaten by starving commie pinkos. And that's basically how Shelburne Harbor, located in Nova Scotia, Canada, became so goddamn important. It sits way up in the North Atlantic Ocean at one of the farthest eastern points of North America, which all adds up to making Shelburne Harbor, as well as eastern Nova Scotia as a whole, strategically critical
in the 1960s for NATO's military strategies, more specifically, NATO's naval strategies.
Natages.
Having ports and shell...
Natages is what we'll shorten it for.
Natages. Well, having ports in Shelburne Harbor and around Nova Scotia allowed for warships, destroyers, and submarines to cut days off of their travel time if they needed to respond to threats against Eastern European allies. It's kind of a big deal.
Uh-huh.
Now, this position also allowed them to be close enough to both the mainland of Canada and the United States that they could easily provide reinforcements if need be. Not quite a middle point, but like a one-third point between the two areas that they really needed to focus on defending.
Yeah.
But that's not all. You see, this position, safely within the borders of Canada, but facing out into the North Atlantic, also provided NATO, specifically the U.S. and Canada, with the perfect location to put the headquarters of the once ultra-super-extra-special-top-secret-secret Global Acoustic Surveillance Program, known as SOSUS. I'm not making that up. It's literally called SOSUS. That stands for Sound Surveillance System. It's a way cooler acronym than the name, honestly.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Sound surveillance is kind of creepy.
Yeah. This gets nuts. This gets wild. And especially, we're framing this in the time period of 1960.
Yeah, it's...
So, 64 years ago, what I'm about to read, right? So... SOSUS worked by having microphones placed underwater in oceans all around the planet. Now, all those mics were wired up to regional listening stations, and all those regional listening stations had wires going all the way up to the Canadian Forces Station in Shelburne, aka CFS Shelburne, which is located in Shelburne Harbor. Now, these microphones were constantly listening for anything unusual, like submarine engines, nuclear explosions, American politicians agreeing, anything that was out of the norm, unknown, or potentially a sign of the end times. Well, once a sound was targeted, they could use actually pretty simple math to triangulate with decent accuracy the location, speed, and course of whatever was making the noise. They could do this for almost anything, moving, going into, or going out of the ocean. You know when you can't sleep at night and you hear a Honda with a fucked up exhaust and you can just like sit there in bed, you can tell exactly which stop signs they just ran or like the direction they're going and what streets they're going to wake people up on. Like you just...
Literally, I hear that all day. Yeah.
Kind of like that. Eventually, crew members from the Shelburne station, once it was declassified and again, it was 30, 40, 50-year-old technology, right?
Uh-huh.
They would speak publicly about how just with their own microphones located there in Shelburne, they could easily pick up the sounds and then locate whales from 200 to 300 miles away.
Damn. That's good acoustics.
That's fucking insane.
Yeah.
And that was 64 years ago when this tech was brand new in 1960, which I also now picture the Bikini Island whale going, Old Ned.
Old Ned.
Yeah.
Yep. Aw, poor old Ned.
You might be asking yourself, why all this NATO jazz? Well, think about it. If every major body of water on the planet is being monitored with the highest level of paranoia, then the odds of noticing unusually large splashing sounds, like, say, one made by a massive UFO crashing into a harbor right next to a super secret military surveillance outpost, might stand out a bit. It, you know.
It's a tiny bit. It's a tiny bit.
Might warrant an investigation.
It's a little bit.
Yeah. I mean.
Yeah. Let's look into that.
A little bit of a thing. And I also wanted to point out, writing that, I remembered Lou Elizondo, former head of ATIP. He mentioned on an interview I was listening with him, and I can't place the exact time. UFO researchers, don't kill me about that, okay?
Whoa.
But it was like within past few months, I was listening to an interview. Oh, God. And he talked about acoustic surveillance, like aquatic surveillance, specifically for the tracking of UFOs.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, I can't talk about the accuracy, but I can tell you the technology's been around for a while and we've been using it, or something along that. He basically was like, yeah, dude, they're monitoring every sound in the fucking ocean.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course we can hear when UFOs go in and out of the water.
Damn.
And so, like, that just coming across this right here and how it ties back, because it becomes a theory about why does what happen next, right? Kind of what a current, I mean, you could call him a whistleblower, is saying that the government is using to track, you know, the movements of UFOs across the planet. So, like, kind of tracks. I don't know.
And nowadays they figured out something called aquatic super surveillance. And it's just ass.
Well, is this proof, right? The fact that the system exists and that they straight up own into the fact that they can monitor all this shit and measure shit going through the ocean. Is that proof they were doing that in the things that lead up to what's about to happen? No. But based off of everything leading up to the Shelburne Harbor incident, the author presents it as goddamn likely, and I'm going to have to agree.
Yeah.
Called it out. Don't want to do wrong by the researcher there. He didn't say that happened.
Yeah. You know, it's circumstantial, but it's highly likely.
So right in the middle of a super secret surveillance facility in like...
Oh, for sure. They were listening.
Yeah, I hope so. Or just like looking out the fucking window.
Yeah, they were just, you know, honestly, they were just like, oh, that's just the captain getting out of the bathtub.
He had Thai food again last night. That's what that was.
Like I said, author presents it as likely. I have to agree. Because in October of 1960, an international naval fleet of 18 warships was assembled and began making their way towards Shelburne Harbor for a joint U.S. and Canadian exercise.
Uh-huh.
Now, these war games they were playing out were a mixture of practical hands-on training and command operations testing, which is a fancy phrase I just made up for getting along with each other. Now, this exercise was super simple, but it was incredibly important for regional defense of NATO allies. Portions of the NATO fleet would basically act out the role of being the Russians and place 8 miles of dummy underwater mines all throughout the massive Shelburne Harbor, right? So there would be a crew of this fleet that would go in, act like the bad guys, really try to fuck shit up. They were all dummy mines, try to fuck shit up. And then these mines, right? These ones specifically, though, these mines were recently developed by the British, and they didn't even need to make contact in order to explode, but they were triggered by proximity to the materials used to make naval craft, making them super sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so after all these dummy mines were in place by the Red Team, and the remaining ships with all sorts of different names and purposes, some big, some little, others just kind of tagging along, well, these ships were the ones that were all playing the role of the actual NATO forces, right?
Uh-huh.
And they were supposed to enter into the harbor and detect, disarm, and clear the mines while moving massive destroyers safely through the channels, right? Basically a giant real-life game of Minesweeper.
Uh-huh.
This was a big deal because European allies relied on imports to survive, and if their waters and their harbors couldn't be accessed from supply boats and freighters and shit like that, entire countries would literally starve to death.
Yeah, for
sure. All the Russians would have to do is just drop some fucking mimes, or mimes. God damn it, he's got us in a box.
If the Soviet Union had started using mimes, we would have lost the Cold War. Okay, NATO would have lost the Cold War.
You can never, could you imagine trying to interrogate a mime?
No, I could not.
No, no one can.
You would never get a straight answer out of them.
No, and I fucking suck at charades. Well, if they were to be cut off by Russians planting mines all around the harbors and the ports, basically entire countries would starve to death. So minesweeping, kind of a big deal. You know, that's why we developed the advanced computer technology to practice it at home. So as this was in Canadian waters, they were leading the joint training operation, right? So the Canadians were in command of the entire NATO fleet that was involved in this, 18 ships, right?
Uh-huh.
Big-ass fleet. And while specialists of all kinds were needed and present, one specialist sat in the galley for an entire week, bored as hell, on standby, drinking beer and reading old Western novels from the ship's library. He was a Royal Canadian Air Force debris and wreckage specialist who the author called Jim. Well, Jim spent the entire NATO exercise on the HMCS Cape Scott, which was essentially the main commanding ship in the NATO fleet, the whole fucking time there. He was just sitting there, drinking beer. He didn't have shit to do. He was just stuck there on standby, right?
Good job. Shitty and good job. But he doesn't sound like he's on standby if he's getting wasted.
That's it.
We need you in action. And he's just like, hold on, let me get us. Oh, hey, there, two of you.
All right, we need the wreckage expert. Jim?
You don't need to keep yelling at me, sirs.
Yep. That's a wreck.
It's a wreck there. Oh, well, thank you.
God damn it, he's a genius. And that over there? Looks like debris to me.
Damn it. You're promoted.
You're the general now.
You're the only man I'll salute to, Jim.
Well, a couple of things you need to know about Jim. Specifically, about how Jim got there.
He stumbled.
See, it's kind of a swaggery saunter where he missed every fifth step. But yeah, so here's the deal. Like, every person who boards a naval ship is to have their name documented in the ship's official logbook. Kind of a big deal in case some shit happens and they're like, who the fuck survived and who didn't and should we be looking for it? It's a big deal, right?
Yeah.
Well, there's exceptions that can occasionally happen, and they are actually procedural. And it all has to do with how they get on the ship, who they come on the ship with, and where they're getting on at, right? There's like very specific spots. Now, in Jim's case, even though he knew everything that happened and people confirmed he was there, his name isn't ever officially recorded. A fact he wasn't aware of. So again, this guy sat there bored as hell reading old shitty Western novels from the ship's library, had no idea that technically on the books, he was never registered as actually being a part of these NATO exercises.
It's because he literally stumbled onto the ship and, and they're just like, well, there he goes. Did he sign the log? I don't think so. He's fine. He's a genius.
Well, like I said, a fact he wasn't even aware of. And this is likely because he boarded at an earlier port with a small crew along with an officer, which, in the logbooks, would have been recorded as the officer's name with a note next to it saying, quote, with extra staff. So pretty much the only way that Jim would have stumbled into this situation, right, and not been logged. Because, I mean, it's not out of the ordinary for a bunch of sailors to be stumbling up into the ship. That's normal. They still got to get their names in the logbook.
Yeah.
But for Jim, stuck in this weird, awkward limbo in the galley, an officer had to have been like, you're coming with me. I have a specific reason that you're coming with me.
Yeah.
Well, Jim would later state that this naval exercise, codename Sweep Clear 5, was the only time in his career that he didn't receive a briefing. Out of his entire naval career, this is the one time where he never got briefed on shit. He was selected, likely came with an officer. Basically, nobody fucking talked to him, but they just said, stay here. You're on standby. Can I drink a beer? Yeah, whatever. You can drink, but just stay right here. We need you. He's like, okay.
Interesting.
It's getting into speculation at this point, but a lot of details are pointing to intentionally sus. It's so sus.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is, you know, we talk about in especially UFO communities, it's like so much stuff is circumstantial about evidence for these things happening. You have to look at that. You also have to look at patterns.
Yeah.
You have to look at specific times for things and overlapping dates and overlapping times and things like that, because it's not so clear, because obviously most of the time there's really no pictures. There's no, like we're just talking about, there's no logs about it, so you kind of have to infer that he was on the ship and through word of mouth and through the galley charged like 10 to 15 beers a day, and it's like, who was that extra guy? It was Jim.
Who was paying that fee?
Yeah, I mean, it's free for him. He's on the, he's not on the log, so.
That's true. Charge her to my room.
Oh, yeah, he's that guy. Jim's that guy. He's like, charge it to my room. And they're just like, you don't have a room. The galley is your room right now. A lot of it is about these like overlapping things, but these overlapping things are like specifically dated and specifically, you know, like quoted. And so
they become significant.
Yep. Because
they become super significant.
They have to be. Yeah.
Why is the one guy who's from the Air Force in a naval exercise that has nothing to do with the Canadian Air Force,
who's
not involved, like, why did they bring a airplane wreckage and debris specialist? Having no clue why the Navy wanted him. Why the fuck did they want him to be there? He did say that, like, there were other occasions where he did come in for the Navy, but A, he was briefed, B, he was logged,
And, like, soon after getting there, it was, one of our planes crashed.
There was a reason. Yeah.
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 It's very fucking obvious, because that's, like, a super niche profession to have in the military, right?
Oh, yeah, he does one thing. He says, that's debris. That's wreckage. Pick it up. Let's go.
It's urgent. Yeah. So, why the fuck would they have him? Then why would they ignore him? Also, how did he ever pay for these beers?
Uh-huh.
Well, it wouldn't be until days into the exercise that Jim would start to pick up on clues as to why he was there. All week long, while Jim was passing time in the ship's galley, he, along with anyone else there at the time, would overhear every single word coming from the table of the naval dive team. They were all loudly and clearly distressed and seemed to be in a state of shock, with a, quote, dark air about them as they spent every evening drinking and collectively trying to process what they had seen.
Wow.
So that loud group that's at the end of the bar that just does not give a fuck about everybody hearing the conversation, that was the dive team. And it was going on every evening. Everybody there was listening to this, which obviously lends its hand to a lot of witnesses later in the story, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, they weren't even being loud. They were just being their normal voice. But since they're underwater most of the time, they have to yell at each other. So they just thought they were talking normally.
They just all forgot to take their earplugs out when they came in.
Yeah.
Well, so that group therapy, sadly, had to eventually come to an abrupt halt when an American officer came and sat down in the galley. Now, according to Jim, and basically just Canadian crewmen on naval vessels, it was normal for American servicemen to join them in the galley. They always made a point to be super welcoming and make them, you know, feel comfortable, and also constantly tease them that the Canadians were allowed to drink on their ship and the Americans weren't. Right, so they would just constantly be fucking with them, like, come on, man, have some rum. Come on, man, do this. And they're like, I can't. I'm not allowed to do this right now. And they're just like, come on. The buddy-buddy, you know, naval
shit.
They're
messing with them.
Yeah. Here's the thing. If brass came into the galley, the entire fucking tone changed.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
The galley was the safe space.
Yeah.
It was the break room where everybody talks shit about what's going on, speak openly. It was their spot for that.
They're at ease. Yeah.
And so as soon as this American officer comes in, everybody making it very obvious, like, we can't say shit to you, but, like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah, perfect.
Well, everyone's cold shoulders came out, leaving the officer to sit awkwardly by himself. What happened next was corroborated by a lot of witnesses, as well as the main Canadian involved. So everything was awkwardly fine until the divers very openly started back up with their conversation, and of course, it was the same topic as every other evening. They were talking about the, quote, guests who were sitting on the seabed just a few feet below the bottom of the ship. Well, as soon as this was heard, the American officer did what Americans do best, and they leaned into the dive team circle at the table and said, quote, might be best if we laid off talking about that Soviet sub that we're sitting over. He seemed to have forgotten that these were pissed off drunk Canadians who already didn't want him there, but luckily, he was allowed to remember very quickly when one of the divers, referred to as Harry, got up and grabbed the American officer by the collar and started screaming in his face.
Oh my God.
So, like, Harry, he was one of the divers. He was just like, you motherfucker, like, just fucking went off on
him. Yeah, right? Just went off. Well, what's crazy, too, is think about, like, him saying that, and then we're in the Cold War, and just being like, oh, fuck, we're in Shag Harbor. We're in this place that, like, it's a base for, a naval base for us in war games to fight the country that's, if they're underneath us, people would flip out and be like, we got to go to battle stations. They're going to attack us.
What you just said weaves into some things that are coming up eloquently, perfectly. Well, Harry got up, shit got hairy, right? And, like, grabbed the American officer by the collar, started screaming in his face, saying something to the tune of, quote, that's the whole problem with you Yankee boys. You see the red menace everywhere you look. That isn't a Russian sub, and you bloody well know it. It might be some other kind of red menace, maybe from Mars, but I think it's from someplace much farther away, end quote. That was Harry's paraphrasing of his memory that when he was super drunk screaming at an officer while people were trying to pull them apart.
Yeah.
And it was also Canadian and old-timey, so actually some of the weird phrasing makes sense. Anywho, Harry's speech went on and was clearly the result of a lot of thoughts that him and his crew had been processing over the past few days. He started yelling about how if the, quote, guests in the water below the ship had wanted to do something, there was obviously no way they would be able to stop them.
Yeah. And
then he proceeded to tell the American he should get himself, quote, a real drink, sit down, and just chill.
Damn.
But the Yankee had no chill, and he ran out of the room. Moments later, quote, the old man, which is naval slang for the commanding officer,
yep,
came into the galley, and because he either assumed Harry was drunk or was trying to save his ass, or maybe both, he ordered Harry to go to his bunk and sleep it off. Harry obviously said the most drunk response possible and said, I'm not even drunk. And then he's like, that's an order.
Yeah, yeah. You need to get out of here right now. This is going to be worse.
So question is, why all that tension and drama? Obviously, intense moment. Like, went off on a fucking officer. Even if they are from another country, that's not good for you, bro.
Not looking good.
Not at all. Well, once the witness statements and the documentation have all been combined, one day stands out above the rest. It was on Wednesday, October 12th, 9 days into Sweep Clear 5. The fleet was roughly 1 hour into its day's exercises when witnesses all agreed that all hell broke loose. Well, the reason for the next command is blurry. It's not exactly known or agreed upon.
Uh-huh.
What is known and agreed upon is that Navy divers were ordered into the water. They were to swim down and investigate the area directly below the commanding ship, Cape Scott, which stood anchored in water only 47 feet deep. It's super fucking shallow.
Yeah, it's crazy for a battleship to go that close.
Yeah, brewing a spoiler for later, but like, you're really going to fit a sub down there in 47 feet of water?
Yeah.
Below a massive fucking destroyer? That's it?
Yeah, not going to happen.
The average heights of them? The shortest one I could find. And that's not even counting the little top hat thing that subs have. I don't know what the fuck that's called, but that little, you know what I'm saying, that little speed. Just the actual height of the main, you know, minnow body of the sub. It's like 29 feet.
Yeah, that's the smallest.
And then it gets up to 30-something feet. There was one that was like five stories and shit. Like, it was like, goddamn. Like,
crazy.
They got fucking huge, you know. But it makes sense, and there's a lot of shit that goes into them. But still, 47 feet of water. And this isn't like nasty-ass, like, Hudson Bay polluted water. This is actually, like, good, clear water.
Yep.
You would be able to look over the edge of a ship and clearly see a sub in the water during the day. You'd be like, what are they doing down there? Yeah, like, it would be very obvious.
Yeah.
So, there were three divers on the team, two of which are named in the book. Harry, the dive team captain, who also just shook the hell out of a officer in the previous story, which actually happens after this, and Wade, who specialized in underwater videography, which I can't imagine how fucking huge those cameras were in 1960. Well, as the team went below the surface and started swimming towards their ordered location, Wade began recording. Within moments, the distortion of the water began to give way to the sight of two large, unknown objects slowly coming into focus as the team swam to their approach. They were massive craft, motionless on the seafloor, classic UFOs, which resembled what Bob Lazar refers to as the sports model, the most classic, iconic UFO shape. They were nestled next to each other. The divers would later say that they had the distinct impression that one of the ships was there in an attempt to give aid, as if the first one had broken down, had crashed, or had been damaged somehow. It just kind of had that vibe of this was a rescue mission.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the surrealness of what they were witnessing broke into panic when the divers realized they weren't alone in the water.
Ooh.
Two tall humanoid beings were in the water with them near the outside of the ship.
Creepy.
They would later describe them as classic-looking gray aliens.
That's creepy.
And, like, you can't even get away that fast. You have to swim, so it's like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Well, once they realized that there were two entities in the fucking water with them, after their eyes kind of focused on the fact that, like, holy fuck, we're looking at two UFOs.
Yeah.
Hey, so this is 13 years after Roswell. UFOs, well known.
Oh, yeah.
Now they're staring at two UFOs in the water.
Yeah.
And the second that this kind of like hit them, all these divers, they swam as quick as they fucking could back up to the surface of the water. I mean, what the fuck else are you going to do? You'd be like, shit, get me out of here.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to greet them. You're like, guns, bye. I'm going to be killed.
You're not like, just, they got a Nintendo DS, damn, let's go introduce ourselves. You know, like, that's not happening, right?
No.
So, soon after making it back to above the water, they called in and reported what they had just witnessed.
Yeah.
Well, that same panic that had just overcame them spread up to the commanding staff because they were like, shit, there's two UFOs and aliens directly below the commanding vessel for this NATO fleet.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of a big deal, right?
Yep.
So this is the moment that the team was ordered out of the water. And when, for the first time, and as far as anybody knows, the only time in recorded history, for just 3 minutes, the Canadian commander in charge of the NATO exercise, Rear Admiral Kenneth Dyer, raised the military alert level to DEFCON 1, the highest possible military alert status that exists. Before Chris Stiles researched this case, it was assumed there had never been a moment in history where the military was put at DEFCON 1. Go check it right now. It still hasn't made its way into a lot of articles.
Yeah,
but he found the fucking deck logs. He found the status report.
That's crazy.
It's still, if you go check Wikipedia, it still hasn't been updated. This is, again, this book's less than a year old. This research has just been released.
Yeah, it's nuclear attack. Yep, if DEFCON 1 is a...
Yeah.
If it happens, that's nuclear attack, yep.
The levels range from DEFCON 5, which is the least severe, right, to DEFCON 1, meaning nuclear war is imminent or has already begun, and that all service members should be at maximum readiness and take immediate response. What does immediate response mean? That means... if you see fucking anything that's sus,
shoot it. Yep.
Like, it literally just means fuck the rules of engagement. It's all out fucking nuclear warfare.
Yeah,
like,
it doesn't matter. Yep.
This is the most intense possible thing.
And that's
that
why Harry
be
beat the crap out of that American right? officer. He was like, DEFCON 1.
But like, dude, like literally the code name for this or the exercise term for this is cocked pistol.
Yeah, it's already ready to go. Yep.
This is insane. And like, it's even more insane to me that like Chris Stiles found out that this moment, right at a moment of like contact with two UFOs and entities outside of the craft, the brass was like, oh, fucking shit. That's what that is.
Yeah.
And because the divers didn't come back and say that it was a Russian sub.
Yeah. 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 Of course they didn't. Yeah.
Which would have explained the whole progress or the whole process of DEFCON 1, they're trying to bomb us. That's the only reason why they're this deep in a harbor.
Yeah.
No, no, no. The divers came back and said they saw fucking aliens and UFOs.
Yeah.
And this is their response.
They're like, man, we're fighting the Reds. Now we're fighting the Grays. Like, they're coming for us, you know?
God, how much of the rainbow do we have left?
We're fighting the color scale.
I swear to God, if they take fuchsia.
We're fighting the rainbow right now.
Well... but I can't drive this point home enough, right? To give an idea of how serious this is, DEFCON 1.
Uh-huh.
Stiles, and I'm really glad he did this, has a breakdown of historical events and their DEFCON levels. The highest level reached during the Cuban Missile Crisis was DEFCON 2.
Uh-huh.
The Persian Gulf War got up to DEFCON 2. September 11th, 2001, only got to DEFCON 3.
Isn't that crazy?
Whatever the fuck happened in this moment...
yeah, it was DEFCON 1.
Raise that
highest.
Level. Yes. This is fucking insane.
Uh-huh.
And the author does a great job tracking down these records. Again, wasn't known since 1960 that this was ever notified, that it ever reached this level. A lot of shit was just kind of like pushed over to the side and hidden over here and hidden over there. The author did something great. Chris Stiles did something great. He tracked the career of Rear Admiral Dyer and started to kind of like get an idea of like, what was he like in other situations, right? Like, was this dude just constantly like, oh, shit, and like hitting the button, you know? Like,
yeah, yeah.
What was he like? Turns out, Dyer, Rear Admiral Dyer, when the Cuban Missile Crisis popped off 2 years after this event in 1962, Dyer was in charge of the Canadian fleet when JFK put out the announcement to all the allies saying, we need you at war ready.
Uh-huh.
Canadian Prime Minister's like, hold on there, hold on. I don't know if we should just go jumping every time Jack says so, you know, like, hold on, let's think about this for a second, you know. Castro, is he that bad? I don't know. We'll see. I haven't got to meet him yet.
Seems like a pretty nice fellow, actually. I kind of like his hat, but, you know, I don't think it'd look good on me. Anyways, I don't think we should go about this just yet. Let's figure some things out, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, World War III, kind of a big deal.
Yes, big deal.
Then all of the Canadian government that would also be in charge of ordering the military to raise it to, you know, the war-ready level also weren't telling anybody to do that. Dyer raised the entire naval fleet to the war-ready status.
Oh, okay.
He fucking jumped rank.
Yeah.
That's important because that tells you that if it was a Soviet sub underneath the ship, Dyer wouldn't have waited fucking all to deal with the situation.
He would have blown it up.
He wouldn't have waited for any approval from anybody. I mean, he literally wouldn't listen to the prime minister 2 years later at potentially the start of World War III.
Yeah.
So like would he started firing on them? Yes.
Yep.
Forcing them to surface?
Yep. Depth charges, get them up.
Yeah. You've got 18 warships that you're commanding in a harbor.
Yeah. Against one sub that has nowhere to go.
That's only 47 feet in the water. You don't even have to guess with the depth charges.
Hey, just drop them. Drop all of them anywhere. You could probably drop one and hit it.
Honestly, some baking soda and vinegar might take care of them. Like, look at them. I got some Mentos and a Diet Coke. Let's see what that'll do. Just drop it down in that little top hat thing they got on those things. You know? But it says a lot about Dyer that, like, within 2 years, he went over the top of the entire government's head and was like, I'm responding to this shit.
Yeah.
Which tells me it wasn't Russian. Now, it's unknown how the DEFCON level was lowered, right? It was enough research and enough work for Chris Stiles to even just find this little moment in time where it was recorded.
Yeah.
So all of the immediate, you know, minutes afterwards, he hasn't come across it. They haven't found it yet. And we don't exactly know what that process looked like. Now, what is known is that the U.S. and Canadian ships, the fleet, quickly positioned themselves near and around Cape Scott, which then remained anchored until Saturday. Again, this was all taking place on Wednesday.
Uh-huh.
Cape Scott, the commanding ship, just was like, nope. Stayed there for 2.5 days, directly above two UFOs that were sighted by their divers.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And when the Cape Scott did begin moving again, it only barely made it down a brief distance of the channel before experiencing complete engine failure, and it had to be towed. What do we know about UFOs? They're great at fucking up engines.
Electromagnetic pulses, usually.
Exactly.
Electronics. Yep.
Now, here's where the story starts to diverge with different theories, secondhand testimony, and speculation, right? So, over and over again, when Chris would interview the divers and the firsthand witnesses, he would notice the exact same reaction when they would get to the same point in their testimonies. From before the dive and all through the experience, up until the moment they all surfaced, the witnesses would always have direct eye contact and be very forward and answering questions and, you know, great with their response. But then they would reach a point where they would have to answer about the Navy's reaction to their report. And by then, they would be staring at the ground. They would then quickly shut down and almost immediately insist on ending the interview. Every single time. And this happened, too, with some of the divers that these original three divers trained, like the next generation of divers.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of in that very small, exclusive club and, you know, talk about that shit, right? And they're
very few of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Like literally one of the most dangerous jobs on the planet, especially in 1960.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. Yep.
We're only like a few decades from back when everybody had to have like a half a suit made of brass on to go underwater with hoses and shit, you know?
Yep. Yeah.
So yeah, very limited, very small club. Well, didn't matter if it was the original divers or their students. Every time they would get to that part about the military's reaction and they would shut down and refuse to keep going with the interview. So, all things said and done, Chris Stiles did a phenomenal job researching what was for 30 years the black sheep of the Shag Harbor incident. So, if you're into doing research or just want to learn what it's really like, I'd highly recommend buying a copy. If not, he did an excellent interview not too long ago on Podcast UFO. Links will be in the show notes.
Do it.
Bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to learn a little bit more about this case. This is the part of the show where normally we just kind of do the discussion. But today I actually have a few facts that I wasn't able to fit in. But first, Joey, what the fuck do you think happened?
I think that some of the divers slept with a couple of the aliens, and when they start talking, they can't talk about it because they had to leave. They had to leave, and one of them had a couple alien babies. No, I think personally they probably saw something they shouldn't have and were admonished and were talked about that they would probably lose their profession if they had recapped what they saw. Most likely is how I think it went down.
When Harry told the story that interviewed, when Chris Stiles interviewed Harry, and again, you know, Harry was older and stuff at the time. Basically, Chris had reached out to him. He was like, hey, I want to talk to you about this. And Harry's like, yeah, how did you hear about that? Yeah, sure. Yeah, I can talk to you about that. And it was through a very odd series of events. It was like Chris Stiles went to high school with Harry's son. So they like kind of already knew each other. It was a harbor town. Connection. So like everybody kind of stays in the same spot, you know, because they're all specialists in this very specific region, you know.
Yeah.
Chris Stiles had a bunch of connections to a bunch of these folks. You know, Harry was like, yeah, dude, I'll talk to you about that. Actually, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go down to the Army-Navy Club. I'm going to ask around and like see if anybody else wants to like contribute and da-da-da. Chris Stiles was like, dude, I don't know if that's such a good idea. You probably shouldn't tell anybody that you're about to talk about this. And he's like, hey, man, it'll be fine. So when they had their, what he basically is an infamous meeting, which was like on Good Friday. I think the chapter's literally called like the Good Friday interview. When they had that meeting, Harry wasn't even going to let him in the door at the house when he invited him over. He was invited to come over on that day.
Yeah.
Just got there. And Harry's like, I'm sorry. I got to think about my pension. I got to think about my retirement.
Yep.
I got to think. Like, so you hit the nail on the head. His tone completely changed. His wife popped up and she was like, oh, God damn it. Just let him in the house. Like, don't be rude. Come on. I already made sandwiches.
Yeah.
And like, she straight up like opened the door. She's like, I've been wanting to hear about this story all week because he hadn't said shit to his family about it ever.
Yeah.
A lot of these divers hadn't told anybody even close to him. So Chris coming up to them and being like, yo, that was the first time they talked about it outside of their tiny little circles.
Yeah. And he's going to make it like big news. So
folks were getting hushed up immediately.
Uh-huh.
And like,
yep, for sure.
Harry had said he was just like, yeah, it's been so long. There's no way they still care about it. Folks are talking about that shit all the time now. Like, he pretty much says that verbatim. And then he gets hushed up
immediately. Yep.
Yeah. So question is, what do you think was down there, though? There was something more than likely. There's pretty damn good odds there was something down there. I don't think a Soviet submarine could have literally fit down there.
No, I couldn't have been. I mean, from just what they're talking about, it most likely was some kind of USO, you know, underwater, you know. And I don't know anatomy of aliens. I guess most people don't about what's going on, but I don't know if they would be out in the water. Maybe they had some kind of suits on as well, you know, who knows? If that's kind of what they saw. But I can tell you that if I saw something like that, I would hightail it the fuck out of the water back to where I was going. And then if somebody asked me and told me to shut up about it, I would beat the fuck out of them and shake them from like what I saw, so that the reaction is super valid comparatively to what happened. So I feel like that is why he reacted that way, is because now he's been told like, you didn't see. And this, it's the same with abductees and people that have had problems. Like, when people say this didn't happen to you, it's super angering because you know that it happened to you. You know that these things are part of your life now, part of a scar in your life sometimes for these people, probably for that guy too.
Yeah.
And it's hard to let that go.
Yeah. And like, not when you're not alone, when you have a crew of trusted folks that were with you.
Uh-huh.
That you work with professionally all the time doing this shit, diving as a team.
Yeah.
And they all saw it. I didn't even get to the fact that it was recorded on camera, which there's a whole another story about, like, immediately when they got back, they were told to go to this location. Like, none of the brass there were looked at the tapes. None of them wanted anything to do it. It was taken straight to a local, like, military, I don't know, base thing or, like, operations facility where they're just like, you two, the ones that recorded it, you take it directly there.
Yeah.
Like, they wanted to minimize the amount of hands that touched it,
basically. Oh, for sure, yeah.
And they were like, you guys take it there. So, you're with your team, y'all fucking see it, and it's on camera.
Yeah.
And then a motherfucker's just like, basically, shut the fuck up about this. It's the Soviets, remember?
Yeah.
Bro, I just found out aliens are real. What the fuck, man?
Yeah, it's big news for somebody like that.
You know? For anybody.
Yeah.
And then somebody like, it's actually something that we can all relate to. Shut the fuck. It's like, no, dude, I'm pretty sure if they wanted to do something, we'd be fucking dead by now.
Yeah, yeah.
They had thought about that shit. I think that the reaction, honestly, I think that they attacked or killed the aliens. I think they fucked them up.
Could be.
Like, I think when they went to DEFCON 1, all the ships came in, and then the ship proceeded to stay there for days. I think that they attacked it, and I think that that's why Harry was so fucking pissed, because there was probably an overall, like, tone or mood that their enemies, their threats, their blah, 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 and that's why he snapped, and he was just like, you fucking see the red menace everywhere, Yankee, da, da, da. You know, he said all that.
Yeah.
I think he was pissed because he was like, dude, they were just, like, chilling down there, and, like, and they all had the impression that it was, like, a rescue kind of situation.
Yeah, to rescue them, yeah.
And, like, they probably, they wouldn't, you know, the divers wouldn't shut the fuck up about it. So, like, they were probably processing it, like, after the shock wore off of, like, did y'all kind of feel that way? Yeah, I kind of felt that way, too. Like, they didn't actually do anything to us.
Yeah.
What the fuck? Why are we mad at them? Like, they traveled all this fucking way, and it's like, we found them, you know, like, they weren't doing anything, you know, like, if they wanted to, I'm sure they could.
Yeah.
Like, you could see how that conversation would go, and you could also see why everybody kind of had this, like, intense, like, drop-off point.
Yeah.
In the conversation where they're like, I don't want to talk about that.
And well, I imagine if it's War Games and the idea behind it, they probably also kept stock of what missiles were on board, and then once they got to shore after War Games and the idea, they obviously keep stock of, like, okay, we shot this many missiles. That happens in military. Like, there's detailed accounts of that kind of stuff. Just like the idea of the logbooks, but that's why they have those.
It's not a bad thing to, like, pursue that, though.
Yeah, to look into it. And so the idea behind it would be, I you know, you're never going to find that kind of stuff, to be fair. It's probably burned. If the records of the video were burned.
I don't know, Chris Stiles.
Yeah, yeah, the bulldog.
80 pages of this book was him just talking about, like, pursuing deck logs. Like, the amount that I just spared y'all from having to hear about deck logs over and over and over. 90% of this, I'm not shitting you, 90% of this book is just him trying to figure out what the fuck dates that the Shelburne, you know, incident took place. He didn't have it as clear sweep five or whatever. He just knew that it was Shelburne, that it was Shelburne Harbor. He had no idea what the fuck dates it happened, right?
Yep.
He had no idea what ships were involved, which that gets really complicated when you're trying to track down every other fucking detail, because he couldn't find any information about this naval exercise.
Yeah.
Up until, like, a handful of years ago, when a long series of fucking events, but basically he had to hunt down old naval, like, monthly magazines that was just, like, just internal service, like, entertainment magazines, where, like, it was, like, the USS, like, Yazoo or some shit, one of the smaller boats there was in charge of towing Cape Scott when its engine failed. And it got a congratulations and, like, you know, and the admiration or whatever. It got, you know, celebrated as being like, hey, you did a good job, you know, like, yeah, so, like, it's got its kudos.
Okay.
And in that small paragraph, which wasn't even fucking listed in the actual index at the beginning of the magazine, and he makes a point to go on for, like, three pages about that. But in that paragraph, they say, participating in a naval fleet exercise, clear sweep five. Or sweep clear five. I always mix up the name. Sweep clear five. That little fucking paragraph was the only thing that he could find in fucking existence that referenced a naval exercise, but it gave him the dates. It then proceeded to help him find the ships that were involved. It then proceeded to help him hunt down logbooks, even though there was a whole fucking thing with, like, why are these pages missing? It opened it up, and that was after 30 fucking years of trying to find information. So, like...
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my God.
The dude just wouldn't fucking stop. Like, he went around. I went to this city, and then I went to this city, and I went to all the used bookstores, and I was looking for this magazine, and so I bought. And I'm a little bit of a naval factoid lover, so, like, it's not the worst thing. You know, I do love the trivia about naval events.
I mean, to be fair, the people writing the logs in for the military should have got Sergei Monast to write their logbooks. Just have a bunch of empty pages in the middle.
Hell yeah. Nice.
Throwback.
And like I said, though, at the start, there's so much more to this case, which is honestly filled with all sorts of levels of nuance that turn very small moments and details into very significant and, like, very important proof. So, you know, for instance, apparently, there is a super secret, you know, at the super secret HQ, the U.S. was also storing these things, which I never heard of before, called Lulus. Joey, do you know what a Lulu is?
I don't, but I got some apples.
Nice. Well, not these kind of apples. See, Lulus were nuclear depth charges.
That's the stupidest idea. Yeah, that's stupid.
Terrible idea.
Yeah, like, you're just going to irradiate the water that's right next to you.
But this does all go back to the long-standing history of UFOs and nukes. Plenty of fucking cases go with that. Like, the amount of involvement between UFOs appearing and doing all sorts of fuckery, especially during the Civil War, or Civil War, especially during the Cold War, doing all sorts of fuckery with, like, turning on Minuteman missiles, turning off Minuteman missiles, fucking with this base, fucking with this base, showing up over here when nobody in the world's supposed to know that there were nukes stored there. Rendlesham. You know, like, all sorts of shit like that, like, happening. UFOs have long been interested in that. So that kind of adds to this a little bit more. Y'all are the shit.
Yeah, thank you for listening to the end on this not explosive episode.
Bye.